Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's Music Row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
Pushkin.
Just a quick note here. You can listen to all of the music mentioned in this episode on our playlist, which you can find a link to in the show notes. For licensing reasons, each time a song is referenced in this episode, you'll hear this sound effect. All right, enjoy the episode.
Flying Lotus isn't one of those producers who just programs beats. He creates an entire aesthetic world for the music he makes to live in. Over the past 13 years, he's amassed a diverse body of work through the label he started, Brainfeeder. He's released 4 solo albums, produced tracks with Kendrick Lamar, Thom Yorke, director-actor David Lynch, and The Climb, featuring Thundercat. Musical innovation runs deep in Flylo's family. His grandmother, Marilyn McLeod, wrote songs for Marvin Gaye, Diana Ross, and other Motown artists. His great-aunt, Alice Coltrane, married and played in John Coltrane's final bands, then after his death, released a slew of classic albums that seemed to grow in stature every passing year. In this episode, Rick Rubin and Flying Lotus chop it up about visiting Alice Coltrane's ashram as a kid, why his peak creative hours have changed over the years, and why he directed a horror flick despite being scared to death as a child by the Thriller video. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's Rick Rubin and Flying Lotus.
How would you say your relationship to music has changed from when you were a kid till now?
It's funny. There's this video of me when I was a little kid, and it was like my mom, my grandma asked me questions. I was like, so Steve, how old are you? And he's like, 2. Like, Steve, what do you want to do when you grow? But I was kind of in this little interview moment. And then I think there was some Stevie Wonder that kind of turned on in the background. And you just saw that I was just like perked up and just was like, I'm out of here. And I was just went toward the speaker. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, that's same. Nothing's changed. I would just say that over time that my relationship with music has just gotten so much deeper. You know, at this point, it's so crazy to think that I thought maybe 4 or 5 years ago that I was the peak of my love for music or my love for creating music. And now I know that I was wrong because I feel like right now I'm there again. You know, I feel like I spent so much time learning things the past couple of years with synthesis and, you know, studying piano and studying harmonic theory and stuff that actually just, gave me another burst of life in this whole thing. You know, I feel like I just added more time to my clock.
That's good for all of us.
I hope so.
What was the LA scene like when you were coming up? What was going on when you first started?
When I first started, the scene that I was really kind of watching was what Stone's Throw Records were doing. They were doing a lot of stuff. Ubiquity was doing a lot of stuff. We had all these cool parties like Pooh Bah and Sketchbook. That was a cool scene. And, you know, there was like a lot of people playing music that we liked, you know, like shit from like J Dilla and Madlib, you know, like kind of beat music. That kind of vibe was going around, and you started to see all these other producer beatmaker kids who were kind of hanging around, but they didn't feel, I think it was like even more underground than Madlib and Dilla. It was just like weird because we didn't care about rappers. We were just like, we're going to do this without them. You know, like we just came for the beats, you know, and I think that was like, that freaked a lot of people out, I think at first, but I think there was at a point where it just didn't seem like rap was going anywhere. So I think the producers were just like, oh, let's just do this. You know, I think the scene was kind of built in the parking lots of a lot of parties. We were just like listening to tracks in the cars, like with the doors open, blasting them out in the parking lot. You know, like that was like a whole vibe, playing tracks on the homies' boombox.
Could you tell that something was going? Could you tell like
there's the vibe?
Yeah, that it was like that. That was important.
Totally, you could totally tell it was important. It was because there were so many people who loved the same things. Yeah, there was just this frustration. There was just like this empty thing. There was just a void still, and I think that became something that I held on to for so long, actually. And try to recognize is that, you know, people need to be heard, and you have to keep your ear out to the scene. You got to keep your ear out. You got to like know what's going on in the streets, man, because you don't want to miss it. You don't want to miss the thing. You don't want to be left out of that new moment, the next moment.
At that point in time, while the underground was just sort of taking form in LA, what was the mainstream of hip hop like at that time? Do you remember?
Oh, mainstream.
Was it still like New York centric or not necessarily?
I would say it was still New York, but it was starting to get Southern, you know, starting to go in that direction. For some reason, I feel like, why do I want to say G-Unit was a thing, you know, like around then? It was like 2005, I guess. So, yeah, it was like that kind of post-Shining Suit era of hip-hop.
Looking back now on the LA scene then, would you say that there were any similar scenes anywhere else in the world at that time, like kind of picking up the same kind of vibe?
Absolutely. There was a crazy synergy around that moment for us because at the same time, MySpace came out too. And that was a way for all of us to kind of hear what everyone else was doing around the world, especially. You know, I think that kind of helped cultivate the scene and let us know that it wasn't just us out there. There's small labels in Europe trying to do this stuff now, and there's small labels in Japan trying to do it. And it was like, okay, well, this is something. This is actually something. And they keep looking to LA. So that was another thing. But I had a feeling then MySpace was kind of popping off and dubstep was kind of popping. It was at the same time, like, so it was like a new electronic thing was brewing. This beats with and the wobbly stuff going on. They were calling it wonky and all. They were trying to find all types of names to describe it. But it was just dope because it was the first time that LA and UK are connecting like this. We're hearing stuff that just was just born in the studio, you know, last night. That never happened before then. So I think it allowed a lot of people to just kind of accelerate the sound quicker too. You know, you hear something and like it becomes part of the consciousness, and then it just snowballs and gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And suddenly, you know, there's hella people trying to do this thing.
Yeah, it does seem like that connection between the UK and LA at that time is a fascinating one.
Yeah, and it was definitely like just the underground sound. You knew it wasn't meant to be for everybody, but people really wanted it. Oh, back in the day.
How did you first connect with Kendrick?
I first connected with Kendrick on Twitter. He was like, have somebody tell Flying Lotus to hit me up. I was like already following this cat. I was like, bro, what are you talking about? I'm here. Hello, here I am, sir.
What did he already have out at that time?
He was still on Section 80, I think, around then. This was still like kind of early days. I think when Good Kid, Mad City came out, he and I met at his signing in San Francisco when that album came out. I came out to a signing and we hung out for a little bit. And, you know, ever since then, it was like, we're going to make something. We got to do something. We got to do a project. We got to do EPs. You know, something. And then the way we really started connecting was, for some reason, he reached out to me because he wanted me to help him make his live show for the Yeezus tour that he did. What a time. I mean, that record right there, that was huge record, that one. But anyway, yeah, I started working with him around then, and I started playing stuff to him on that tour that kind of had that sort of like Parliament sound to it, kind of like funkadelic sound, and he was really feeling that, and that kind of kicked things off to Pimp a Butterfly, and it kind of, you know, that was kind of the beginning of our collaboration for our song Never Catch Me, and that was a huge.
Did you go on the tour?
Yeah, I was on the tour for a little bit. Yeah, I was there. I was there for the first few stops.
How was that?
It was cool. It was really trippy to have been part of that show, and I'd never done anything like that before. I'd never helped anybody build a live show, so it was really fun. I never thought that would happen.
It sounds great.
Yeah,
it sounds like a fun experience, and it's interesting to get to experiment in new arenas. It's just fun. It's a fun, you know, if all you ever did was just sit and make beats forever,
I know.
But then when you go and do something else interesting and then you come back, you get to make beats again and it's incredible all over again.
Yo, yeah, that's the thing. Like anytime I have to do anything else, I get so excited to just go home and make some beats. Yeah. Please just let me make beats. That's it. That's all I want to do.
I found the same with working on different kinds of music. If all I ever did was make hip hop records, it would have gotten old a long time ago. If all I made was heavy metal records, it would have gotten old. But the fact that I get to really submerge myself in different things keeps it really interesting. It's always new. I never know what's going to happen next. And that's a good feeling.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about your creative process. Like, are you always making something? What's the rhythm of your work like?
I'm kind of similar. You know, I'm always in something, but with music especially, I'm like so in it right now. And always trying to learn more. You know, I think whenever I get in a place where I feel comfortable, I'm like, all right, I need to learn some more stuff. I need to learn how to do things that I don't know yet. And this kind of quarantine time has been really good for me to just kind of focus and hone in on a couple little things that I wanted to learn. You know, I really wanted to understand synthesis on like a very detailed level. You know, I don't want to be one of those people who's just like always using the presets and stuff on synthesizers. I wanted to know like exactly what everything does. And I spent time like just digging into that. So now I can go up to any of these boards. I know exactly how to get the sounds I want. And, you know, that's just like a little bit of time that has now, you know, changed the rest of my life now. Like, I know from here on out, I'll be able to get busy on it, you know, like I always wanted to. So, yeah, I don't know. My process, though, I wake up early. I'm not one of those people who stays up till crazy hours. I wish I could.
What are your hours?
Usually I start the day at 6 in the morning and then I go to bed like 12, 1. But I'm like always on the machine between, you know, work hours. I try to treat it like a job now, really, where I'm just like on it 9 to 5 at least. And then if it's super inspiring, keep going. But at 5, I feel comfortable like stepping away and throwing on some cartoons.
Yeah. From the time you wake up, how soon do you start working?
Usually after I brush my teeth and do all that stuff, you know, I'm like right on it. I feel like that's my best energetic moment. It actually is when I'm like just fresh out of bed, ready to work. You know, sometimes after coffee and a joint or something, I'm good to go. But I wish I could do the late night thing, because I do find that when I'm up late at night working on music, that I'm less inhibited and the ideas, they're not as, you don't think so much. You're just kind of like flowing. Whatever the ghost is just like, it flows through you way easier, less cerebral, you know. But I also find that I'm way less attentive to detail, and I don't really care about the little things as much. It's just like all idea.
Do you think that has to do with you and how long you've been awake, or do you think it has to do with something else?
For me personally, it's definitely time of day and energy. I feel like by the time 8 o'clock rolls around, you know, I've like smoked like several blunts and, you know, I'm tired and, you know, it's just, I feel like I need a lot of energy to make music, personally. I need a lot of energy, or else it's just going to be like, you know, a couple chords, and, you know. I need to be able to, like, I need to have this pulse in me, like, when I'm working on stuff, or it just don't work. So, whenever I got that, when I got that energy, it's good to go.
Has this schedule and that rhythm of working always been your whole life?
No, I feel like I only really started waking up early when I started having like British management and my record label, Warp Records, they're based in the UK. So I think I started just getting used to getting emails and phone calls super early in the morning. So my brain just kind of goes like, well, they might be trying to find me. I don't know, you know, maybe my brain just starts going. But before then I was definitely like a night owl, but now I've just kind of adjusted to, you know, always being awake.
it's so funny you say that. When I was when I lived in New York, I was on the late schedule, and I would usually sleep until 3, and then probably not be outside until it was dark, and then that would be my schedule, and you know, go to sleep sort of typically heading home as the sun was coming up was typical.
Yeah, that's the artist special right there. That's it.
So in the morning, you brush your teeth, you go into the studio, and how does the process start? Like, what's the first thing you do?
Well, lately, what I do now is I try to just write some patches in the keyboard or like synthesizer stuff. I go up to a machine, one of my machines, and try to make a patch that I have not heard before, whether it's like a cool pad sound or a cool lead tone, something, because then that will inspire an idea, always.
So it starts with a sound.
Yeah, usually starts with a sound. Or, you know, I'll just start playing keys, play some chords, and then, you know, then try to find a sound that goes with it, and then a thing happens. But yeah, I love just trying to write patches. I think that's been a really fun kind of thing to add to my daily routine, is I have to make a new sound today. What does it sound like? And, you know, what can I apply from other things that I've learned to it? Can I mix it with samples? You know, what happens when I run through a reverb, this, that, whatever. And then maybe that's the beginning of a song. And like the past few times that I've done that, it comes out as a song.
Does the sound, from the time that you get the sound where it's like, okay, this is the sound and you're inspired by it and you feel like, okay, now I'm ready to develop past finding the sound, does that sound ever change going forward? Or is that sort of the central theme that is unchanged regardless of what else goes on around it?
That part is usually unchanged because I feel like I end up structuring everything else around it, you know? But sometimes you find that, oh, well, this sound was actually too bright in the context of the track now. So you gotta, you know, filter it down a little bit and then change things. But yeah, usually it's the spark happens with that sound. It's like, oh, and then, you know, you start like, oh, it sounds good with these drums. And you're like, oh, and it just keeps going. And, you know, 2 hours goes by.
Yeah. Typically, how long does it take to find the sound? And from the time it takes to find the sound, what give me an idea.
It can take from like 5 to 20 minutes, I think, to write a patch. When I'm not in a hurry to put something out, I really do enjoy recording sounds and recording noises, grabbing different tones and things, because that's my palette. That's what I have to work with. And, you know, we're kind of in this time where everyone is using like the same sounds and the same drums and the same noises. So for me personally, I'm in this place now where I'm trying to go out of my way to make sure that all the sounds that I have are unique.
So you're working on the sound. What's the feeling in you that tells you, okay, I'm going to move forward with this sound? What does that feel like? How do you know?
It's like, it's the same sound as when you hear that break on a record, you know, where you hear some shit and you're like, oh my God, I got to sample this. Where it's like, it almost feels like you cheated. Like, it's just like, there's no way I'm supposed to have this right now. No one's watching, you know, it's like, it feels like that. And that's when you know. And then you like, you get you like, you play some chords and there's like a little like chord that sounds like, you know, that's when you do it. When you hit the record button.
Yeah, it's a thrilling feeling, isn't it?
It is. It's addicting. Because, you know, every time you feel like you're getting close to that perfect beat, that perfect thing. And it never is, but you just feel like, oh, you're almost there. You know, if only.
Typically, do you work on music thinking it's going to be instrumental? Is that the typical default?
No, there's no default. I think I just try to make stuff and then serve whatever the sound is later. You know, like, it's like, okay, this don't need nobody. Just let it be. But I think lately I do write music with vocalists in mind a lot of times, because there's, you know how it is, there's people knocking on the door. You know, I'm working with Thundercat, you know, and all these different people, and they're gonna want tracks. So I always try to keep that in mind, but I don't ever go into a thing thinking it's gonna be a certain type of track. But I like to just kind of, yeah, just feel the ghost. Where are we going? Well, I don't know. But you got me hyped now talking about making tracks right now.
We'll be back with Flying Lotus after a quick break.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented 3 new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at marketmessage2024.com right now. Again, the link to watch is marketmessage2024.com. That's marketmessage2024.com.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
We're back with Flying Lotus. After talking about the difficulties that come along with directing movies, Philo tells Rick about his great aunt, jazz legend and spiritualist, Alice Coltrane.
How would you say the creative muscle is different between making music and making film?
Making films and making music are so different, and there's such different muscles, but it's weird because there are things that relate, where especially with producing, where, you know, it's up to us to kind of vocalize a lot of things that are in our minds and manifest these ideas to people who can, they have these different tools and different things that they bring to the table. So you have to be able to wrangle each department and be able to communicate with them this grand vision that you have. Same with music, same with film. Both of those things relate. But I would say film, it's way more fucked up because there's way more money involved and there's way more people involved. And when it comes to music, I can just sit here in my room and make an album alone, really. But with film, you could do that, but it wouldn't be the most interesting movie in the world. But, you know, if you did it with CG animation or something, that could be great. But it's hard to make a movie on your own. I think producing, making beats and stuff, it lends itself to people who are kind of more introverted, introspective. But I think with films, you have to really be able to be outward and expressive, and it is a different muscle for sure.
Yeah, it sounds like with music, you have to motivate yourself to do it. And with a movie, you have to motivate the cast and crew.
Yeah, absolutely.
To get the vision to come to life.
Yeah, and you have to obviously be the most motivated, you know, like, because there's no one who's going to be nearly as motivated as you on your film project. It's hard. It's hard. It's one of those things where, you know, if anyone ever recommends, like, what should I do? How should I? Like, don't do it. don't do it.
But would you imagine doing it again?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I will. Yeah. I don't know if I recommend it for everyone, but I definitely will. But, you know, the things that I've done, and, you know, I've learned so much in my process that you can't wait to do it again because of all the things that you've learned. You say, okay, well, next time I make a film, I could do it like this. And, you know, it's like coulda, woulda, shoulda, hindsight. It's crazy, you know. So when people are building things and constructing props from your imagination, and you're seeing these things manifested and people acting out dialogue that you wrote, there's no drug that can compare to that. Nothing like it.
How did you choose to make that particular movie? Are you a fanatic of horror movies?
I love horror films. I love horror films. I've always loved horror films, especially because when I was a kid, I was terrified of horror films. Until maybe like 10 years old, I was like really afraid of these movies. You know, like Freddy Krueger, he would always be in my dreams and stuff. And it'd be like, so like, why would they make these horrible things to frighten us? You know, and even like Thriller, I remember that video was like so scary when I was a kid. I didn't want to see the Thriller and see Michael Jackson change and none of that stuff. Just, I couldn't deal with it. And eventually when it starts to get fun and you're like, oh, this is just props and effects and stuff. And you learn all the stuff. I just fell in love with it. I think because it was so scary to me, I loved it so much. And yeah, I love the genre. I love horror. I love horror films and scary games and, you know, the macabre. I love all that stuff. But I also love funny stuff too. I love when those things can intersect. I don't love serious horror as much as I like funny horror and being able to have fun with it and be playful. I guess because life is pretty serious enough, you know, life is pretty real. So when you can have your horror with comedy, it's a lot easier to digest for me these days. But I think when it came to me making my own movie, I wanted to make something that I know I'd have fun with, because making movies is hard as shit. I was like, yo, I want to make something that every day that I work on this thing, I'll have a great time. I'll laugh my ass off and, you know, just it'll be a blast for everyone in the process.
How much does the work that you've made in the past influence the work that you make now?
That's a good question. You know, I think that's why, you know, side projects and alter egos become so attractive to people, to artists, is because they get to take a little bit of pressure off themselves to explore different things. Yeah, I definitely feel the pressure of things that I've done in my catalog. I mean, man, you must feel the pressure of your beard, dude. Like, come on, man. Like, like, you know, like that beard, you know, like people are like, oh man, Rick Rubin. It's like, you know, it's a thing, man, you know.
I would say it's more itch than pressure. It's like more itchy.
I mean, what was the last time you thought about cutting it off?
I've never thought about cutting it off at any point. But I also didn't think about growing it at any point. It just kind of happened.
Right.
It was, I decided to stop shaving, and this is what happens when you stop shaving.
But you know, if you cut it off, that shit would fuck people up.
Me especially. Me especially. Right, right. Wouldn't recognize myself. Tell me about Alice.
Oh, yeah. Alice was just always auntie. You know, she was auntie. She was my closest aunt, one of my closest relatives. So my experience with her was really unique. I saw her as, you know, my grandmother's sister mostly. But she was also, you knew that she was this very special, unique individual. And as time went on and as I grew up and, you know, I just would respect her more and more. Every decade, I was just, wow, my auntie is an amazing human being. Oh, wow, my auntie's amazing. You know, I remember going to college and then really, really falling in love with her music and coming home from college. And it, you know, it was like, wow, teacher, where have you been this whole time? You know, you were just telling me how to just, you know, rake the lawn and stuff. You show me different things on the piano, but I didn't know how deep it went, you know, because I felt like in my youth and in a lot of her lifetime, she was John Coltrane's wife. That was her thing. You know, she wasn't Alice Coltrane, a great jazz icon in her own right. People were always asking her, what was it like being John Coltrane's? You know, and it was like, she didn't have any problem with that. But I think that just kind of became her thing, you know, for so long. So the emphasis wasn't on her music or on her personal legacy, or it was always about his. And, you know, I think only towards the end of her life, she really started getting back into making music again. And then that was, you know, it just kind of, we started to see her as the artist again, you know, the things that she would create, because she took so much time off of it. I mean, I'd see her a lot. I've never seen her practice. Yeah, never see her practice. But I'd see her play. She'll play, But there was never that time where I come by this auntie and she was at the piano messing around or anything. Never, ever, ever, ever. And yeah, but she would unleash on Sundays at the ashram. But yeah, never practiced.
Tell me about the ashram. What was the scene like at the ashram?
Ashram has this beautiful, beautiful land in Agora Hills, and it was recently destroyed by the fires. We had the wildfires 2 years ago. And but the ashram was beautiful. It was just a big space, and it was, you know, as soon as you would get out of your car, you would notice just how you could hear a pin drop. It was just so quiet there, and you know, there were people wearing white everywhere, and like you know, koi fish ponds and stuff. It was very, very, very beautiful. But again, it was one of those things that I kind of just took for granted because it was there my whole life. And, you know, it was just something that we did on Sundays. But then as you get older, you start living, you see how amazing spaces like this are. And it was a very unique experience.
Did she ever talk about spirituality with you?
All the time, yeah. Yeah, she would. And she would always be kind of my spiritual guide, I guess. And, you know, I'd call her up whenever I had a question about the universe or wanted to try to make sense of this world, help me understand. She would always have the right thing to say. Yeah, she's so unique.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with Flying Lotus after a quick break.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented 3 new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at marketmessage2024.com right now. Again, the link to watch is marketmessage2024.com. That's marketmessage2024.com.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest.
We're back with the rest of Rick's conversation with Flying Lotus.
What are you working on now? Can you talk about it?
Yeah, a few things. Actually, just as a fun thing, I was friends with Johnny Ramone from the Ramones, and Ramones were one of my favorite groups, top three favorite groups. And they made an album there, I think it was their fifth album, called End of the Century with Phil Spector. And it's as a Ramones fan at the time, I remember I was in junior high school when it came out, and I already loved the Ramones, maybe high school, first year of high school, maybe. And I remember buying the album and putting it on and being so disappointed because I loved the Ramones so much, and it didn't sound like the Ramones. And it just broke my heart. And then years later, I met Johnny, and then who lived in LA. When I moved to LA, started hanging out with him. And I told him the story when I heard the album, and he said it breaks his heart hearing the album because he said they're great Ramones songs, but the way they were presented didn't sound like the Ramones. So he always thought it was a miss. And his dream was for someday that album to be remixed and re-released as a proper Ramones album. Again, not to take away anything from the original version, both of them, you could listen to them back to back. So through a series of events, we tried doing it about 10 years ago and it didn't come together. And in that time, Johnny passed away. And I always felt like since he passed away, I always wanted to make his dream come true, like a tribute.
Oh man, yeah, yeah.
So we're just finishing that now, and it's
all good.
Yeah, and it's just like it's just a feel good project, like an artist's dream gets to come true posthumously.
Yeah, that's good. What do you want to be different about it?
He just wants to sound just like a Ramones record, like much more stripped down, much more direct, much more raw. Just to sound like if you listen to their first four albums, to have this fifth one sound like what you'd expect after those first four in the trajectory instead of the left turn. And it's interesting too, like I like left turn albums. You know, I like both.
Some people though, right?
Yeah, depends on the artist.
Some people don't want them to change. That's what's fucked up. You know, it's rough.
Yeah, it's one of the things I recommend young artists is if they want to have that ability to do that, it's important to set that standard early in their career.
Yeah, that you change all the time.
Yes, like if you make four albums that are very much like volume 1, 2, 3, and 4 of the same idea, if volume 5 is really different, there's a lot of people who are just not going to like that.
It's real. It's so real. Yeah.
So it's almost like, in a way, it's like training your audience to be open.
Yeah,
to go on the journey with you. It's like if you listen to the Beatles were clearly well received, and if you listen to the 13 albums from the beginning to the end, they don't sound like the same band. Like they radically change every two albums, radically, and those were typically 13 albums over 7 years, so it was two albums a year. So every year they were a different band, essentially.
Yeah, that's hard. It's hard to do, but yeah, I think doing the same thing would be such a drag, man.
But then, like, if James Brown did something else, I don't know right. if I want to hear it.
Right, right. Yeah.
I'm very happy with the James Brown trajectory.
Yeah. There's certain artists. Yeah, a lot of them. You just don't go there. You don't gotta be that person. Don't do that.
Yeah, I think it has to do with how much the artist is a genre defining artist, maybe. I don't know.
Sure.
I don't know. Something I never thought about before, but be interesting to understand why certain artists you're excited about them to change and other artists you don't want them to change.
Yeah, because I think you might be right about that. If they define a sound and then they step away from it, then it might be way, way too jarring.
Yeah, that was the experience with Yeezus. There were a lot of people who were not on board with Yeezus.
Oh, God, man. Yeah, totally. And to me, that's my favorite of all his stuff. I think it's the most different. But yeah, the first listen was like, what the fuck is this shit?
The fuck is this? Where the fucking sounds at? There ain't no sounds on here. And then you're just like, whoa, this is some other futuristic shit. You know, it's cool.
I can remember also hearing Trouble Funk for the first time, right in the early days of hip hop. The only way that I was able to hear, the only place you could hear hip hop when I was growing up was WHBI had a Mr. Magic show, which was like an hour long mix show of, I'll call it underground hip hop, because there was only underground hip hop at that time. There was no above ground. You know, it's all the hip hop in the world was underground at that time. And you couldn't hear it on any mainstream station ever. But this one weekly show for an hour played hip hop records. So we took it very, we cared a lot about that show because it was the only source of hearing this music. And then one week he played this Trouble Funk record, which was like, and it was also like a 7 or 8 minute track, which out of an hour show, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a rap record.
Yeah. Why y'all did?
Yeah. It's like, why did you give away our
time? Why y'all
eating
up all the time with this?
Exactly. And I would forward, you know, the cassette, I would forward through the cassette past the Trouble Funk song to get back to the hip hop records.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then within a couple of weeks, the only thing I would listen to on the tape was the Trouble Funk song.
Yep. Yep. That's how it goes. I always think about that. Like, I always try to spot out my least favorite song on the record that I listen to. And like, all right, is this going to be the one that I actually fall in love with? Because that happens so much. So much.
Yeah, it happens also sometimes with the thing that you love the first time you hear it might not have staying power.
Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah.
So, I mean, sometimes it does, but sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes it doesn't. The first thing, that the single or whatever, that thing you fell in love with is like, yeah, that was cool. But this other, the deep cut, though, that's going to last me the rest of the year.
Yeah. Can you think of any music in general? Any, like, I remember when I was a kid, classical music didn't speak to me at all. And now I probably listen to that more than anything else.
Definitely classical for me. I didn't really vibe with it until I heard Stravinsky, hearing some of that stuff, and then I connected it to Fantasia, and then I was like, oh, okay, all classical music is just Fantasia. You know? with no images. Okay, cool. It's all this vibrant cartoon that keeps changing. And, you know, obviously your connection with it changes, but yeah, I think that was huge. Falling in love with that music and just kind of being open to that at an early age, I think was so good for me.
My favorite thing is new old music.
Old music
that I haven't heard before. Yeah. That's the best. Because I just like the way that music's made, and it's a flavor I like, and I'm really used to all of the stuff that's familiar. But when I can hear something in that flavor that's not familiar, that really feels like it expands the mind.
Yeah, same. I've been on that too. And like, anytime you just like, you find something from the 70s you haven't heard before, you're like, oh, wow. You know, you can dig into it. And you know, like, it's going to have certain instruments, certain ideas and techniques of how they recorded it and everything. What have you been vibing on though?
Just a lot of all different kinds of old music, a lot of old psychedelic music, a lot of classical music, a lot of jazz, kind of the new, you know, the new classical. It's like somewhere in between new age and classical, like Max Richter and Nils Fromm. And I don't even know what you really call that. I guess it's
contemporary classical. I don't know. But yeah, that's the vibe though.
Yeah, it's often electronic based, but doesn't have to be. It feels inspiring. It feels like they're using the same machines in different ways, and I like that.
Do you like Philip Glass and Ryuichi Sakamoto?
Yes, Ryuichi Sakamoto. Amazing. Incredible.
Yeah. I've been listening to a lot of his stuff, and it's so crazy to hear all the different vibes that cat's been across, you know, like from the 70s to now. He was always in the electronic music, but always in the kind of classical and playing and whatnot. And
It's wild to hear the stuff he was doing back then kind of sounds so new and fresh.
Also, a lot of, you know, David Axelrod's always coming out.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
Do you ever hear that there's an album he produced of the Electric Prunes?
Yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah, yeah, it sounds amazing, too.
Yeah, I didn't, and the way I found it wasn't through him. It was just through listening to old psychedelic music, and that came up. It's like, oh, this is different than everything else.
And who produced it, right?
it turns out he produced it, but yeah. I didn't know that. It's like, why is this different than everything else? Why is this so special? Then I listened to the whole album before I even knew he produced it and thinking like, this doesn't sound anything like anything this band did before this. This is a unique moment.
Oh, yeah.
Cool. A pleasure. I look forward to hanging soon.
Yeah, I would love to. For real.
A pleasure, sir.
Thank you very much. Much love.
Thanks to Flying Lotus for talking shop with Rick. You can hear all of our favorite Flylo tracks along with a bunch of other songs he's produced over the years on a playlist at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. And be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at YouTube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast. There you can find extended cuts of our past episodes. Broken Record is produced with help from Jason Gambrell, Mia LaBelle, Leah Rose, Eric Sandler, and Martin Gonzalez for Pushkin Industries. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented 3 new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. He put everything you need to know in a new presentation specifically designed for people off Wall Street. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at newstocktrend.com right now. Again, the link to watch is newstocktrend.com. That's newstocktrend.com. Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
I'm Ben Natifafri, host of the history show, The Last Archive. And I want to tell you about a new series we're running in our feed. It's called The Deadline. 6 essays written and read by Jill Lepore, the New Yorker writer, American historian, and founding host of our show. These are incredible essays on everything from the history of cryogenics to the Silicon Valley gospel of disruption. And at the end of each essay, I interview Jill about her craft as a writer. You can listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.